Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Drug poisoning is now the leading cause of unintentional death in the United States. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, leading to a record 48,000 deaths a year. The opioid epidemic is tearing families apart, with parents desperate to help their children. And help seemed to arrive in 2008 when Congress mandated that the insurance companies pay for addiction treatment, and then again when Obamacare allowed children to stay on their parents' insurance until age 26. But as it turns out, treatment is big business, and where there is that much money involved, nefarious actors and Wall Street as well will step in. In her recent Mother Jones magazine investigation titled "Mom, When They Look at Me, They See Dollar Signs: How Rehab Recruiters Are Luring Recovering Opioid Addicts Into a Deadly Cycle," Julia Lurie reveals how this vulnerable population is being exploited. It's in the magazine's March-April issue, and I'm very pleased that it brings Julia Lurie to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Your article highlights an aspect of the opioid crisis that was unknown to me, and I suspect most of our listeners. Some, but not all, recovery clinics pay patients to stay with them, knowing full well that those patients are likely to use those payments to buy more heroin?
So it's usually paying in the form of some kind of perk if it's happening. So, you know, sometimes it can be free rent, or sometimes they will employ people on the side who will in turn pay in the form of, you know, hotels or, you know, trips to the nail salon or perks like that. And sometimes it is just pure cash.
Now, you tell the story of a 20-year-old woman you've called Brianne. I assume that's not her real name. But could we call her a poster child for this opioid epidemic?
Yeah, you know, we could. She is, she was like, you know, a high school softball star who experimented with pills and then became addicted to heroin and got caught in this cycle. And she, like many people who, you know, are approaching rehab for the first time, had sort of assumed that, you know, she would go somewhere and get clean, and it would take maybe a few weeks or a few months, and then she would come back home and sort of move on with her life.
Well,
and
go ahead. No, you go.
And in the end, you know, she went down to Florida for rehab, and she ended up being, you know, shuffled between different rehabs in Florida for, you know, the better part of a year. And she never really, during that time, got better.
She was offered $1,000 for her first week at a facility and then $500 every week after. Who made that offer?
So that offer was made by what we call a patient broker. So this is someone who is usually employed either formally or informally by the rehab to basically go and find patients. And patients equals, you know, beds filled, which equals insurance money coming in. So he found Brianne at another rehab. He was a recovering user himself, and he could relate to what she was going through. And he basically said, hey, after you finish with this rehab, if you come to this facility for detox, I will pay you $1,000 when you're done. And, you know, every week thereafter, you'll get $500. And if you refer me patients, I'll give you $400. So if you can imagine, you are, you know, someone who has been addicted to these drugs for a long time and you are recently in recovery and someone offers you that kind of cash, you know, you go for it, and often you spend it on drugs, which is exactly what happened.
I was interested in the name of the treatment facility, Recovery Villas of the Treasure Coast. It doesn't sound very medical.
It doesn't. This is pretty classic. A lot of rehabs that we had today are these small mom-and-pop facilities, often in the residential ones especially, are often in beachy places where you can go and check out and go off the grid for a little while. And they often offer, not things that you would think of in a hospital or a clinic, but things that you would think of as part of like a resort. So, a pool and maybe like massage therapy, and depending on the treatment center, maybe there's like equine therapy or music therapy, which is, I'm sure it helps to make these places more inviting, but there's nothing about that that's evidence-based when it comes to actually making someone recover from addiction.
There are also 12-step meetings. Did the center help her get clean?
No, that one certainly didn't, and many thereafter didn't. And 12-step meetings is sort of falls in this category of things that work for some people, but there's not a whole lot of evidence behind them to suggest that they work well for a general population. But again, it's sort of the treatment that we know and has been around for decades and decades, and sort of is assumed that that it works well, when in fact, rates of relapse when people go straight from detox to abstinence-based treatment like 12 steps is really, really high.
Didn't Daniel, the patient broker, encourage Brianne to refer clients to him? What would she get out of it?
Well, she would get $400. For each patient. So there's really big money in this. And again, it's often in the form of cash. So Daniel, as I understand it, had a system set up with recovery villas where if he referred patients to them, he got a certain amount of money. And so he would sort of try to recruit patients in any way that he could, including asking current or former patients to then refer patients to him, who he would in turn refer to recovery villas.
But it seems like he had a financial interest in keeping Brianne and some of the other people he worked with addicted to heroin. He sometimes between stays, Daniel rented a room for Brianne and a few other clients at a Super 8 or Comfort Inn and supplied them with heroin, and also with the overdose reversal medication Narcan, just in case. Now, why would he be promoting addiction if he's supposedly helping getting people off of drug addiction?
Because when Brianne would go back to recovery villas, he would get a cut of the insurance money. And if she didn't go back to treatment, he would get nothing. And this is, perhaps the most insidious difference when it comes to the differences between the rehab world and the medical world at large. When a hospital, for example, is consistently delivering low-quality care and patients are consistently being readmitted for avoidable problems, then that hospital may be penalized by insurers. That hospital may be dinged. But that's not really the case with addiction treatment. So if you are a rehab, you are effectively incentivized to, build insurance, obviously, when the patient comes, but then to have them come back so you can bill them again. And, just to be clear, by no means all rehabs do this. There are plenty of very good and ethical rehabs out there. The issue is just that for a patient or a loved one of someone who is going through addiction, it's almost impossible to sort of tell the difference between the good and the bad.
But in the case of recovery villas, they had created something that was like a revolving door. Daniel would make sure that Brianne had access to heroin, and when her drugs ran out, recovery villas would arrange for another day, another stay at one of their facilities. Didn't the FBI raid recovery villas on suspicion of insurance fraud in about a little over a year ago?
Yes, they did. And as far as I know, Recovery Villas is no longer operating. That said, there were plenty of rehabs that Brianne did go to that are still very much up and running that seemed to have similar practices. So one of the main things that you're seeing as a challenge in dealing with this is there are so many, like I said, of these small mom-and-pop rehabs that it's almost like whack-a-mole for law enforcement, for cops, and for the FBI, because they might find one that has these really bad practices, and they might shut it down, and then another one pops up, and then another one pops up.
Has Daniel ever been arrested?
Daniel has been arrested, not for patient brokering, but I believe for drug possession in the past. So, you know, this is as far as I understand it, is very, very common for someone to be in a position that he's in, where he's effectively making money off of people relapsing. And he's sort of one of the lower-level people doing this. There are some people who are doing this for their full-time jobs and making, you know, tens of thousands of dollars each year, often thousands of dollars off of each patient referral. And so, again, it's similar as it is to rehabs with brokers, where there are so many that I think, especially for the lower-level ones, it can be hard to crack down on them.
Isn't what we've been talking about called the Florida Shuffle?
Yes,
although
exactly.
It's not unique to Florida. But this is a cycle wherein recovering users are wooed aggressively by rehabs and freelance patient brokers in an effort to fill beds and collect insurance money. Is this all about insurance money?
It is largely about insurance money, yeah, because that is what is fueling these patients to be able to come, who and in turn these rehabs to be able to keep their doors open and make a profit. So, yes, it is called the Florida Shuffle, and it is a bit of a misnomer because it's happening all over the country. But there's this whole little cottage industry that's basically developed in the murkier parts of the rehab world, where brokers or rehabs will offer drug users perks directly, and that can be in the form of flights or free rent, you know, a few nights at a hotel between the rehabs, or cash. And so it's very, very easy for people like Brianne to fall into this cycle where they go to rehab for a few days or a few weeks. Rehab collects insurance money. The broker gets a cut of that money. The patient leaves, and they relapse, often with sort of the help, either directly or indirectly, of the broker. And then they go back to rehab. And that happens over and over again without the patient getting well.
Go ahead.
Well, the overarching reason that this can happen is that financially speaking, these rehabs are incentivized by relapse rather than recovery. And also because this is an extraordinarily unregulated industry. And so you have this combination of a lot of people pouring into the rehab industry, needing good treatment, and yet pouring into a structure where there's not a whole lot of regulation and not a whole lot of evidence-based care.
Don't drug policy experts point out that the basic rules of medicine don't apply to addiction treatments? And is it true that many of these centers don't even employ a doctor?
Yes, that's exactly true. I mean, imagine going to a hospital or a clinic for any other, you know, medical issue and them saying, we don't have a single doctor or nurse on staff. That would be a bit of a red flag. And yet that is very, very common for rehabs not to employ a single licensed doctor. In some states, the regulatory requirements for nail technicians or barbers are higher than for addiction counselors. You know, in California, for example, which has among the nation's loosest rehab regulations, aspiring counselors need to do a little more than complete a 9-hour orientation that's good for 5 years before they can start working in a state-certified treatment center.
In California, they call an area Rehab Riviera.
Yep, that's the area sort of in Southern California. Again, you often see these rehabs popping up in beachy, vacation-y places that can be very enticing for someone who is using or recovering to come out and hang out in the warm weather and supposedly get treatment.
I'm speaking with Julia Lurie, whose article, Mom, When They Look at Me, They See Dollar Signs, is in the March-April issue of Mother Jones magazine. This is WBAI, New York 99.5 FM. You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large. How much did Recovery Villas charge Breanne's insurer?
Ooh, I would have to look back at that.
I have it written down if you want me to.
You have it written down.
Well, yeah, I actually read your article. $3,000 for a routine drug test, and in one case, $22,000 in rehab charges in a single day?
Yes. So, first of all, thank you for thank you for backing me up there. Yes, it is very common for rehabs to be charging, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for a given, you know, week or month stay. And, you know, I have sort of mixed feelings about this because on the one hand, that's pretty common for the rest of the medical industry. So if we're going to expect If we're going to have the same expectations from rehab as we do from, say, hospitals, then, you know, maybe we shouldn't be so surprised that they're going to be charging that kind of money. But then, on the other hand, clearly a place like Recovery Villas was not providing good care, was not helping make Breanne better, and so does not seem to be in a place where they should be charging that kind of money.
But there's a lot of money involved. It can be $50,000 to $100,000 a month in some cases. Didn't the BRAF group, which covers healthcare trends, warn investors that when the money flows in, so do the ne'er-do-wells?
Yes, that's exactly what they said. And they said that in an investor report that came out in 2014. And at the time, and still to a degree, there was a lot of investment money and private equity money going into rehabs. And so they were basically saying, look, this is a very hot issue. It's growing really fast. And also, as we've seen many, many times before, when the money comes in, that means that also people who don't necessarily have the best intentions are going to be flowing in as well. And that can bring the entire industry the kind of attention that it doesn't want.
In Breanne's case, she was covered by her mother's insurance. What was her mother's reaction to the issues that Breanne faced while she was in the care of Recovery Villas?
You know, her mom, Jen, this was like a nightmarish roller coaster ride for Jen as well, because Jen, you know, had the insurance and had sort of assumed that she would be able to find a place that would be good for her daughter. And she was sort of caught in this horrible place of feeling pretty desperate. You know, she wanted her daughter to get treatment. She wanted her daughter to survive, and also simultaneously pretty powerless to not only find a good place, but also when her daughter was getting these incentives, like, you know, cash, $500,000, to do anything about it. And, you know, she would sort of fall into this place where she would be trying to track Breanne's cell phone, even just to see, like, where was Breanne today? Is she at a rehab? Is she at a hotel? Is she at a morgue? You know, that was the ultimate fear. And, you know, Brianne would pop up once in a while. She would maybe call. She would maybe come home for a few days at a time, but then would sort of be always lured back to, in her case, Florida, and back into this cycle.
Because the recruiters from various treatment centers or Brianne's own boyfriend would get in touch, and then she would be actually paid, her flight back to Florida would be paid for?
Yes.
And they would charge the mother's insurance company for that as well?
Well, not directly. That doesn't, like, show up as, you know, on their claims, but they would overcharge for other things and then have money to pay for a flight. Daniel would get back in touch, for example, the broker she was working with, or her boyfriend, who may have been receiving cash from Daniel, would get back in touch. Or in some cases, people who were, you know, official employees of rehabs who were working, as marketers or recruiters for rehabs would get in touch and say, you know, hey, do you want to come back down? How are you doing? Like, can we help in your recovery process? If you want, we can fly you down. So, you know, sometimes the incentives are very overt. You know, I will give you cash. I will give you drugs. I will give you, you know, nights at a hotel for you to come down. But sometimes they're much more subtle. And coming from people that you would think that you should be able to trust.
Now, you say that the treatment centers are phase two of the addiction epidemic. There's a big story in the news today. The maker of OxyContin has agreed to a $270 million settlement in Oklahoma because of all the deaths there. I guess every state could sue eventually, but is that where we have to stop this thing initially?
Well, that's a good question. Sorry.
I mean, is it the pharmaceuticals is selling opioids, pushing opioids, the beginning of this whole process?
Yes, selling opioids was certainly the beginning of this whole process. And over the years, you've sort of seen this epidemic morph. So it started in the late 90s and early 2000s with pharmaceutical companies, and Purdue in particular, really over-marketing and misleading doctors and patients about the addictive qualities of these pills. And so you had this this very quick rise in the amount of prescribing that was going on of these painkillers. And then starting a few years later, around maybe 2010 or so, you saw the influx of heroin. So that meant that a lot of folks who were already addicted to painkillers were, in some cases, transitioning to heroin. And then you saw the influx of fentanyl, and this was just a few years ago. And fentanyl is an opioid that is several times, you know, orders of magnitude more addictive and more potent than heroin or OxyContin, for example. And so that is, the fentanyl now is where you're seeing a lot of death, because it is just so potent, and not just fentanyl, but synthetic opioids in general. So we've sort of seen many different iterations of this problem, and now we're in a place where opioid prescribing, you know, painkiller prescribing is down among doctors, so we don't have quite as many painkiller prescriptions as we once did, although still far higher than we did, say, before this marketing campaign in the 90s. But it's sort of evolved into its own beast, where fentanyl and heroin is killing a whole lot of people. So that is sort of, all of that put together is what I think of as phase one. Phase two is that we have all of these people who are in dire need of good treatment, and flowing into this rehab system, this recovery system, that is really not working, and in some cases, deadly.
Now, the insurance companies must be aware of their role in all of this. First, they underwrote the epidemic by paying for all of the prescriptions we're talking about, and now they're paying for the fraud that followed. What responsibility do they have in helping people like Breanne and her mother?
So the insurance companies are caught in a tough spot. They certainly have some responsibility, no doubt. But they are they're required to cover often they're required to cover substance use treatment and mental health treatment. So this goes back to a number of laws that have been passed over the past decade, starting with the Mental Health Parity Law in 2008 and then with the Affordable Care Act that basically said, look, if you're an insurer and you are going to be providing coverage for other medical problems, you need to also be providing coverage, then that same level of coverage for mental health and substance use. So this was seen as a really amazing thing when it came to substance use treatment because millions of people were, you know, all of a sudden covered, especially by the Affordable Care Act for addiction treatment. And at the same time, you didn't see the sort of regulatory requirements for rehabs kicking into place. So you're, again, just sort of in this place where you have a lot of money flowing in and you have a lot of patients who are newly covered by the ACA, yet can't necessarily access addiction treatment that is good. And insurers are in a place where they are required to cover addiction treatment, and yet it's hard to gauge the good from the bad when it comes to rehab, especially when it is out of network. So typically, insurers will, you know, do a more rigorous vetting process for rehabs that are in network. It's not always great. There are plenty of places that are in network that are not particularly reputable, but it is sort of, you know, they are investigating those places and overseeing those places more. The rehabs that are out of network, they have much less oversight of them and much less often bandwidth or resources or desire to investigate those places. And so you have people like Breanne going down to Florida to a rehab that is not in network and that seems like it would be really good and so worth spending money on when, in fact, it's a scam.
Now, is this a state-by-state issue? Because all the states administer the Obamacare, for example, in different ways. Have any states made it illegal to pay kickbacks for referrals? And on a federal level, didn't Congress pass an act called the Eliminating Kickbacks and Recovery Act just this past fall?
Yes. So there has been slow movement towards regulating specifically the brokering and kickback side of things. So, in general, in the medical industry, it is illegal to provide perks and kickbacks to doctors or to patients. However, again, when it comes to rehab has just been sort of thought of as this separate thing, this separate siloed thing from the medical world, and so that hasn't often applied in rehab. So, you know, Florida really took the lead when they prohibited patient brokering and they made patient brokering a felony, actually, and patient brokering being defined as giving perks to patients or receiving perks for patient referrals. And a handful of states have followed suit. However, many haven't, and many haven't sort of cracked down on this yet. So one thing that that state authorities in Florida were telling me is that sometimes they will shut down a place, they will charge people with patient brokering, and then the same rehabs or the same people will go set up shop in another state where they don't have these rules in place yet. And like you said, the federal government did try to start regulating this. So you know, in legislation that was passed late last year, the federal government prohibited patient brokering, effectively prohibited rehabs or people from receiving perks for patient referrals. But again, this is such a sort of everywhere problem that that it's hard to crack down on. And for the federal legislation, you know, that's up to federal authorities to crack down on. And you know, it's a relatively new law, and so far there haven't been any indictments for patient brokering, as far as I know.
I'm speaking with Julia Lurie on Let It Lopate at Large today. She is a Mother Jones reporter in San Francisco who covers public health with a focus on the opioid epidemic. We're back with Julia Lurie, whose article, Mom, When They Look at Me, They See Dollar Signs, How Rehab Recruiters Are Luring Recovering Opioid Addicts Into a Deadly Cycle, is in the March-April issue of Mother Jones magazine. If you are looking for a rehab center, how do you know which ones to trust and which ones aren't? Do we know what percentage of treatment centers are engaged in these kinds of activities?
That is an excellent question. We do not, is the short answer. We don't know how many are engaged in these nefarious activities. It seems to be very common, whether people are engaging in brokering or whether they just simply don't have evidence-based care. So there are a few things that patients and their family members can do to try to find better places, one of which is just simply beware of free stuff. You know, it's illegal for a rehab or a patient recruiter to offer perks like flights or rent or food or cash or certainly drugs to potential patients. It's very common, but it's illegal, and it's often a red flag for places that are not operating particularly ethically more generally.
After she was at home and on the mend, Brianne heard from a recruiter for another center who promised to fly her to the facility and not tell her mother. And she went along with that?
She went along with that. You know, she was home and had been trying to recover and hadn't been using opioids for months. And I think that this is a pretty typical story where you have someone who was addicted, was sort of going through this nightmarish phase of addiction, and then in recovery is sort of figuring out not just how to not use drugs, but also just what to do with life more generally. You know, in the case of Brianne, she had a DUI on her record as a result of one of the trips down to Florida. And she hadn't enrolled in school, and sort of all of these things that help prop up your life and give it structure, she did not have. So she was sort of spending her time at home, frozen by this sense of like, what do I do? She was sleeping a lot. She was staying up late watching TV. And along comes someone who sends her a Facebook message and says, want to come down to Florida? I have a really good relationship with this detox, and I promise that they won't call your mom.
She was prescribed clonopin, a benzodiazepine. I'm probably mispronouncing these things. And also
clonopin, yeah.
Suboxone, an opioid used to stave off cravings for more potent narcotics. Was that an appropriate treatment? Doesn't the FDA recommend against mixing since both can wind up impairing breathing?
Yes. So there were a couple issues with the treatment that Brianne got when she got back down to Florida. First of all, she was prescribed benzodiazepines and opioids together, and that is something that the FDA warns strongly against because both of them can depress breathing. But also more generally, she was prescribed Suboxone, which is an opioid that's used to stave off cravings for more potent narcotics, even though she hadn't used opioids in months. So her opioid addiction was not something that she wanted or needed to be treated by an opioid replacement therapy, and yet it's just sort of what was given to her. And so when Jen would try to call her on the phone, you know, Brianne was slurring her words, her tone was pretty flat, and she just again, was not was not making any sort of progress towards recovery.
You've written about other families as well, including Becky Sarnicki, who's a Pennsylvania nurse. Her 23-year-old son, Nick, attended a rehab in Los Angeles in late 2017. How much did his rehab cost his mother's insurance companies?
When he went to L.A. in late 2017, he went through four rehabs in 5 weeks. Ooh. And racked up insurance charges in excess of $100,000.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, Becky Sarnicki and her son Nick is like, you know, this is the nightmare scenario. This is what everyone does not want to have happen to them. You know, Nick was in touch with a broker. His name was Brad. And Brad would give him not only places to go to rehab, but also in between rehabs, he would give him heroin. And
black tar heroin.
Heroin. It's actually what the heroin looks like. It literally looks sort of like tar. And Brad would use between rehabs and then go to rehab. But he ended up dying after he overdosed. He was in between rehabs. And Brad, in fact, was the last person that he ever texted. And Nikki is this nurse in, or sorry, Becky is this nurse in Pennsylvania who had been hearing bits and pieces about her son's, you know, process in LA, and you know, had to be the person to get that phone call.
Now, you mentioned earlier that this is all the result of two things that looked like very positive kinds of legislation. Congress passed legislation requiring private insurers to offer the same benefits for mental health and addiction treatment as they do for other medical services. And then the Affordable Care Act allowed people like Nick to stay on his parents' insurance until they're 26 years old. But this opened up new opportunities for bad actors to make a lot of money. And didn't Wall Street also get into the act?
Yes, so a lot of people have made money in the past few years off of this increased coverage. So, you know, roughly 3 million people with diagnosed substance use disorders gained coverage from the ACA. Between 2011 and 2015, the private insurance spending on patients with opioid addiction grew tenfold. Mm. So Wall Street took notice, and, you know, over the past few years, the number of mergers and acquisitions, for example, related to drug and alcohol addiction programs have skyrocketed. They doubled between 2013 and 2016. Nearly 50 private equity firms have entered the market over the past 5 years.
It began in 2014 when a rehab chain named American Addiction Centers went public on the New York Stock Exchange, and it attracted investments from Morgan Stanley, BlackRock, and others. And now you say 48 or 50 have entered the market over the last 5 years?
48 private equity firms, yes. Yeah. And, you know, with more people heading into rehab and more money to pay for it, of course the investment community has noticed and is interested.
Do we know how many licensed treatment centers there are in the United States?
So there are roughly 14,000 licensed addiction treatment facilities. And they serve on average less than 100 patients at any given time. So unlike hospitals, for example, where you tend to have big institutions serving hundreds or even thousands of patients at a time, and it is very systematized. For rehabs, you have a lot of small mom-and-pop places. And, you know, that comes with pros and cons. Pros, maybe the treatment in some cases is more personalized. But the con is that it's very, very hard to regulate all these places. And you're not getting a sort of baseline standard of care that you would expect from, say, a hospital.
Are the centers that Brianna and Nick entered licensed And what would licensing entail?
Many of the centers that they both entered were licensed. So places are typically licensed by the state. And often they're licensed, they're accredited by something called the Joint Commission. The Joint Commission is an independent organization that accredits places for being safe and clean. You know, they do this for hospitals and clinics all the time, and they also accredit rehabs. But one of the things that I found for the Joint Commission in particular is that, you know, this is an organization that accredits medical facilities. So if they give us their seal of approval to a rehab, often a rehab will show that gold seal of approval on their website. And, you know, people who are visiting that website or visiting this rehab will sort of assume that means something, will assume that that this is a good, clean, safe, evidence-based place. And in fact, the Joint Commission is perfectly willing to accredit rehabs that use abstinence-based only treatment. So say things like AA and NA, rather than using evidence-based care, which can include medications. You know, one woman, Samantha Arsenault, who is the director of treatment advocacy at an organization called Shatterproof, and they do a lot of advocacy on bettering the treatment industry, said that it would be like giving a cancer center accreditation because they have licensed physicians and exit signs over the doors, but they only treat cancer with grape juice or meditation. And, you know, the Joint Commission, I reached out to them about this, and they said, you know, we are not prescriptive as to the kind of treatment that they give. The other issue is that they don't regulate recruiting and business practices. So in the end, a number of rehabs that have been rated by the Florida authorities were certified until the day that they were shut down by authorities.
Didn't the Joint Commission certify a center that forced its patients into prostitution?
Yeah, so this is one of the higher profile rehab shutdowns, and this became a federal case. It was the rehab of Kenny Chatman, who was sentenced to 27 years in prison for committing healthcare fraud and for coercing patients into prostitution. And this is an example of, again, a place that was certified by the Joint Commission until the day that they were shut down.
Do the treatments vary from center to center? Are there any agreed to medical standards for treating addiction?
Yes. So there's a huge amount of variation. When it comes to opioid addiction specifically, the evidence is behind a combination of things, a combination of usually medicine-based treatment. So we're talking, there are three medications that are licensed by the FDA to be able to treat opioid addiction. Those are Suboxone or buprenorphine, methadone, and a medication called Vivitrol. So there are three of those medications that have a lot of evidence behind them. And yet, only a third of licensed rehabs across the U.S. offer any of those medications. And in fact, only 2% of them offer all three of those medications. And what's really important here is that when it comes to recovering from opioid addiction, different things work for different people. So it's very easy for people to say, you know, this thing worked for me, AA worked for me, NA worked for me, therefore it must work for everyone. When in fact, that's just simply not true. You know, AA and NA work wonders for some people. Buprenorphine works wonders for some people. Vivitrol works wonders for some people. Sometimes, you know, a combination of all sorts of things work well. And the reality is that people need options. And people need to be able to make those decisions by themselves and ideally, you know, with a doctor who has expertise in addiction. But when only 2% of all licensed rehabs across the U.S. offer all three medications, that's really hard to do.
According to a report from the Center on Addiction, as of 2012, only six states required addiction counselors to have a bachelor's degree. And you point out that the regulatory requirements for nail technicians are higher in many states. California requires a nine-hour orientation that's good for 5 years. In writing about these people, the patient brokers especially, did you meet any of them?
Yes, I did. And in fact, you know, one thing that's important to note is a lot of the people who are patients and going through this are also brokering on the side, sort of as a side hustle. So someone who, you know, like Brianne might be going through and getting treatment herself might be offered $400 to refer patients to another broker. So it's very, very easy for people to sort of fall into brokering themselves. And, you know, I think probably the most memorable broker that I heard from was someone that I call Peter in the story.
A young man, just 22 years old, but he called himself one of the five leading brokers in Los Angeles?
Exactly. So I talked to him for the first time because he actually called me. He had heard, I think through some moms that I was poking around on this issue, and he called me out of the blue, and we talked for several hours. And he basically wanted to set the record straight, and he wanted to set the record straight on what he saw as this gross misrepresentation of brokers and marketers. So he at the time was a full-time broker living in L.A., and he doesn't call himself a broker. He calls himself a marketer. And effectively, his job was sort of a mashup of caseworker and hustler and friend and advisor to parents on the best rehab options. So he would help coordinate travel, and he would help addicts get clothes and food and hotel rooms if they needed, but you know, when they arrived in a given place, and in some cases cash. And you know, I could see why Peter was good at his job. He was very disarming. He was very up to date when it came to the regulatory landscape of brokering and what's legal where. He, in fact, used to work in Florida and had moved to California after Florida lawmakers had started cracking down on patient brokering. And, you know, someone like Peter will say that he has the patient's best interest in mind, that he talks to patients, that he tries to understand, you know, what kind of treatment works for them, what they want, what they don't want, and set rehab up accordingly. But the reality is that someone like Peter has no training in this. He has no license to be doing what he is doing. And often just the incentive structure for him is pretty perverse, because he is being paid when he gets someone into rehab. And so, of course, he's going to want to send people places.
And he's paid handsomely, between $5,000 and $12,000. Dollars are about $500 an hour. And he asks in your article, what do you expect when they decided that we're just going to put no laws in place and let a bunch of drug addicts help other drug addicts?
Yeah, he described the situation as the wild, wild west. And he was very, reflective in a way about what he was doing. He said point blank that he was being lured by treatment centers who were paying him, and the clients were in turn being lured by him.
Now, are brokers the only way to bring in new patients? I would think that the internet would be a way that many of these places would try to attract people.
The internet is a huge way to attract people, and often works together with brokering. So often people who are looking for patients will scour support groups on Facebook in particular. So, one of the brokers that I spoke with, their job was basically to look through support groups on Facebook for moms in particular who, you know, had these struggling kids and were struggling to find rehab for them. And so when a mom would post something like that, this broker, their job was to respond and say, I'm so sorry that you're dealing with this. I think I can help. Can you give me a little more information? and go from there. And again, if you're a mom and you're in this very desperate situation where you just want your kid to get help and you don't really know where to turn, then someone reaching out to you like that is going to sound very promising.
This is a man named Ian Treacy, founder of Amethyst Recovery. And he, on the surface, it seems reasonable to offer to help mothers who post on a public forum, but didn't you obtain screenshots of an exchange between two Amethyst marketers and a mother who posted in A Mother's Hope? What was the nature of that exchange? And would you describe it as predatory?
Yes, I would. A Mother's Hope is a Facebook support group for moms of kids struggling with addiction. And Treacy actually created that Facebook group himself, and it's pretty big. It has 14,000 members. And yeah, I acquired a screenshot of a text exchange between two marketers for this rehab called Amethyst. That is the name of the rehab that Treacy started. And they were offering their services to a mom who had posted in A Mother's Hope, the Facebook group that Treacy had started. And the mom had indicated that she was a federal worker, that she worked for the post office, and that led one of the marketers to speculate that she probably had Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is a good policy. And he texted his worker, his coworker, to say, "I'm moving in on the kill." And the coworker texted back saying, "I hit the bitch again," since she didn't answer, and I didn't get anything, so while I pissed on that hydrant, it's not mine.
These are classy people, obviously. Are policymakers becoming aware of the abuses of these centers? Didn't Congress recently require the Department of Health and Human Services to develop best practices for sober homes?
Yes, they did. So what you're seeing is steady but slow progress. You know, the opioid legislation that passed last fall requires the Department of Health and Human Services to develop best practices for sober homes. And now patient brokers, at least in theory, can face federal fines of up to $200,000 and 10 years in prison. And in a handful of states, brokering is illegal. But enforcement is spotty. So in some places, like in Palm Beach, they have a whole team of people who are devoted basically specifically to shoddy rehab places. Meanwhile, in a place like California, there are only 44 investigators who are supervising the roughly 2,000 state-licensed treatment facilities. And they don't have a whole lot of power at all over the unlicensed facilities and sober homes.
Some of the stories you tell in your article are really tragic, people dying of overdoses or becoming homeless. This sounds like a hopeless situation.
It can be a hopeless situation. I think where there is hope is it's very hopeful and inspiring to talk to someone who has found treatment that works for them and is in recovery. It is like, for me, it's like one of my favorite parts of my job is to hear these success stories, because the success stories do exist. The challenge is to find a place where you're going to be successful. And frankly, one of the big revelations for me from doing this story is that, you know, often successful treatment means staying home, staying where you're from, and working through this in your own community. You know, not always, but often that is what works best for folks. We sort of have this image in our head of, you know, when you go to rehab, you go to a place that's, you know, sort of beachy and far away, and you get clean, and then you come back and you move on with your life. And in reality, this is a years-long process for a lot of people that, you know, often needs to be treated like any other chronic disease. So like diabetes or like heart disease or something, where, you know, eventually you're in a place where you have stability in the rest of your life, but maybe you need to be on medication, or maybe you need to be seeing a counselor, or maybe you need to be going to meetings, whatever it is that works for you. But that does not necessarily mean being far away and removed from your life.
The title of Julia Lurie's article in the March-April issue of Mother Jones is something that the son of one of the mothers she spoke to said to her, "Mom, when they look at me, they see dollar signs." And the subtitle is "How Rehab Recruiters Are Luring Recovering Opioid Addicts into a Deadly Cycle." Thank you so much for being on our show today and sharing all of that information.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Julia Lurie, to Susie Stultz, who produced today's segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Let It Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Let It Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Let It Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.